It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert will be back with us on Monday. Coming up on Central Time, we'll find out about an effort to provide mentorship to middle school boys in Wisconsin. First, state employees are leaving their jobs in large numbers, and the improving economy may be partly to blame. The number of state workers leaving their jobs reached a high last year across the nation and here in Wisconsin. The Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel obtained some numbers on this trend through an open records request. With us now to look at those numbers and what some of the causes might be is Jason Stein, state capitol reporter at the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel. Jason, welcome back to the show.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Can you start, Jason, by giving us a sense of how serious, how big an exodus of public employees there is? What are the numbers here?
Sure. About 3,600 state workers left employment with the state last year. That's about 12% of the total employees outside of the university system. And that's up 23% from the previous year, and it's nearly double the number that left the state in 2010 when the recession was most serious.
And you've got numbers going back about 10 years. This is the biggest departure, right?
Right. It's in at least a decade. So of the years that we have on before us, it's by far the largest.
Do we know what kind of jobs we're talking about? Are particular areas hardest hit?
You know, there's a whole range. I mean, one thing that's striking is that it's really across a number of different professions, but certainly the healthcare professions in particular are seeing double-digit increases to, 15, 20%, and even in select cases higher than that.
Is this a Wisconsin story, or are there similar things going on around the country?
Well, that's a good question, Rob. I think it is a national trend, clearly, and I don't think the data is there to say whether or not Wisconsin is worse. I think the data that we do have suggests that Wisconsin is similar, and it's a number of things that's going on. It's the changes in the economy. It's the austerity measures, I think, to a certain extent, that you're seeing enacted in a number of states, not just Wisconsin, but certainly in Wisconsin as well. So I think there's a lot of factors at play, potentially.
Yeah, you talked to some experts and people involved in this story, and let's start with that notion that, in a way, this is a good news story about the economy giving more options to people currently in state jobs. What were people saying about that?
Sure. I mean, I don't think this is necessarily a bad news story. And in 2010, when there was a relatively small number of workers leaving state government, I don't think that was necessarily a good news story either. Obviously, the number of workers that are leaving for reasons other than retirement is what has really grown. And so what you saw retirements, continuing to be pretty high with the baby boomer generation nearing that age. But then when the recession was at its worst, you saw workers hunker down, not go to other jobs, and not necessarily have the opportunity to do that. As they have more opportunities in the economy, they are taking advantage of those and leaving state employment. And then, for the public and for elected officials have to think about, is this the right number that we're retaining? And if it's not, what do we do to, bolster that?
And Jason, I should ask to clarify, when we're talking about the numbers of people leaving state employment, is this voluntarily? Is this people leaving to go to other jobs or retiring versus jobs being eliminated? At least these numbers.
Right, exactly. That's a good question. All we have is the numbers that are leaving to retire, which is high but not at its highest levels, and the numbers that are leaving for other reasons. And that would be, for resigning to take a new job, for layoffs, for, any number of reasons, including if you pass away. That's another reason where you're not able to continue working for the state at that point. So it's all those things. But I think clearly, people that are leaving to take other jobs are going to be the bulk of that population.
Talking to Jason Stein from the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel, the paper recently got new numbers looking at how many state workers are leaving employment here in Wisconsin, and it's a high, at least for the 10 years they have data. Last year was the biggest number of workers leaving employment with the state. Jason, we heard from Albert on our Facebook page. He writes, like any other hiring entity, you have to make it worthwhile to come work for you. You can't keep taking away benefits and expect to attract and retain workers. And you talked to at least one union official, too, who pointed toward Act 10, taking away some collective bargaining rights and then declines in benefits as part of the factor here. Is that part of the story?
Well, you know, again, in 2011, as part of Act 10, the average state worker saw their take-home pay decrease by about 8.5% to cover their health and pension benefits. Since then, there's been two across-the-board raises of 1%. In a couple years, the current budget, there's not any across-the-board pay increase. You know, there are some merit increases. So is that the only factor? No, but of course, when you have things like that happening, I mean, that's any worker is going to take an 8% pay cut into account as they decide, you know, is this employer someplace where I want to continue working, or, you know, if I have an opportunity to move to a different one, is that something I'm going to do?
For people who aren't state employees, there might be a so what factor here. Is there a thought that a higher turnover in these state jobs might lead to worse public service for citizens of the state?
Right. Well, I think with any story there, you always have to ask so what. And the so what in this case is that, you know, there's a cost associated with paying more to keep workers, and there is also some cost when they don't leave. We've reported on higher than usual vacancy rates at state prisons. Obviously, at institutions like those, if you can't simply shut down the prison if you don't have enough people come into work one day. You're going to need to pay overtime to have the facility run and continue to be safe. You do have to pay training costs when you bring in a new worker. You know, and you may also have a certain opportunity cost in if you don't have a experienced worker, they may not be able to, you know, a new employee may not be able to do their job as efficiently as someone who's been doing it a few years. So, you know, those are the balancing tests that elected officials have to make and administration officials have to make as they try and get a happy medium for the state.
You mentioned bringing in new workers, and earlier this year, Governor Walker signed that civil service overhaul. Can you remind us what that did and what the goal is there?
Right. So at that time, they said they needed to modernize state hiring practices because of the large numbers of workers that were leaving because of retirements. They made reference to the baby boom generation, and that is certainly a factor. What we're seeing is actually a bigger factor at the moment is people leaving for other jobs. So the state is saying that one of the things they need to be able to do as a modern employer is to quickly and efficiently hire, promote, and, you know, in some cases, fire state employees. And they said that civil service overhaul would do that. Obviously, critics of the bill said that it might open up the process to political influence, and that could have a negative effect on how well the state can recruit and retain workers. So you have a back and forth on that law.
Jason, as always, thanks for talking to us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Jason Stein, state capitol reporter from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We've got a link to his story, by the way, on the Central Time Facebook page, and you can share your thoughts on the numbers of state employees leaving state employment over the last year. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Passover begins tonight. On Food Friday, we'll get some Jewish recipes from the Mediterranean world. First, after noticing a lack of special programming and mentorship for young boys in Madison, several efforts have sprung up to help fill that void. Young and Gifted at Madison's Kennedy Heights Community Center is just one example. In Young and Gifted, facilitators help lead discussions, cook dinner for the boys, help them with homework, check in with their teachers about their grades. It's a program geared toward middle school boys. It serves a large segment of boys who often are racial or ethnic minority members in low-income neighborhoods. Marquise Mason and Russ Faulkner join us now. Russ is a past AmeriCorps member. Both are co-facilitators of the program, Young and Gifted. Russ, Marquise, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks.
Marquise, let's start with you. Can you tell the story of how Young and Gifted got started?
So I actually got there in June of last year. And so at the time when I was there, the name of the group was originally called Brothers, Inc. I didn't really like it too much. I was trying to think of something that, you know, was very powerful, something that would catch on at school or around the local community. So after, I think, an hour debate on, I don't know how many names they tried to pick, we decided on Young and Gifted.
And why focus on middle school boys in particular?
I just remember that age. It was a lot of things going on. You know, you're kind of, I feel at that age, you kind of decide on, you know, what way you tend on going. It's very easy to get distracted. For me personally, I know that I was very sports orientated, so I was kind of put myself around people that was kind of that same mentality. And I know that, you know, with middle school kids, it's very vital for them to have a path or have a general direction of where they're going around that time.
And Russ, let's bring you in on this now. What working with the kids in the Young and Gifted program, what kind of needs do you see? What kind of challenges are they facing?
Sometimes they're individual to the kids themselves. We, you know, because of the neighborhood we do serve in, a lot of times it's struggles economically. You know, they come from working class families. They may have learning disabilities. They may have rough family situations. So they kind of come from all different backgrounds, and so, to a degree, it's individualized, but overall, you know, boys of this age are all going to be having some of the same things, interest, questions about life, about growing up, you know, things like that.
As I understand it, this is not a tutoring program where you're there and you're helping them with their long division or something like that. What kind of skills, Marquise, are you focusing on here?
Well, let's not get away from it. We do focus on academics.
Oh,
it's
you do.
A big,
okay.
It's a big part. But just that, you know, it's kind of, you know, what it takes to kind of be a man in society. Every kid's going to face their different hurdles, but I believe that, you know, me and Russ try to focus on things that'll make them, you know, positive and constructive adults later on in life.
And Russ mentioned a lot of questions that that the boys have, these programs. What kind of questions are they bringing to you? And I imagine it's probably different for everybody, huh?
Yeah. So some of the questions are, you know, we have, you know, 12 through, you know, 14-year-old boys. And so there are questions about sex, you know, and other types of questions, and we speak frank and honest about it, and what we think are good ideas and maybe what we think are bad, you know, or maybe not such great ideas as far as you know, what they should do in certain situations. And we try to help them out, but we're also, like I said, honest and real with them. So, and then, as Marquise was saying, we're definitely not a tutoring program, but we do put academics really high up there. So
yeah, how do you see your role? You're not a teacher. You're not a buddy. I guess mentor is the word we keep coming back to. How do you see that role of a mentor?
Yeah, it's a mentor, but it's – I know that I actually grew up in a program, a Life as a Boy at Vericourt Community Center. And I never saw the guy that was leading it. I never saw him as a teacher. I kind of saw him as someone I can always rely on, a very consistent an adult. So that's what we kind of want to be. We are a very consistent adult, but also – with the understanding that, you know, we're not your friends. We are adults. Respect us as adults. But understand at the same time, you know, we'll do almost anything that you need us to do in order for you to get what needs to be done.
What kind of results do you see? Just, you know, one-on-one talking to the kids here and maybe longer term in their report cards or their performance at school? Russ, what have you seen?
I think a lot of times, you know, some of the kids want need more individual attention, and if you give that to them, I think it makes a difference with their grades. But another big thing is the kind of social-emotional aspect. You asked, you know, what sort of questions. Well, it may not be a question as much, but one of the other things that you struggle with as a young man at this time is, you know, anger issues. And so one of the things we talk about is conflict resolution and how, you know, you can quote unquote be a man, but you don't have to always fight. You don't have to always be angry. And so basically it's just, like I said, trying to be that positive, you know, positive male role model and try to kind of get away from what I personally kind of call toxic masculinity. Mm-hmm. So
Marquise, do you want to talk some more about that idea on man skills in a way?
Yeah, I mean, and it's a very broad term.
Yeah.
And with the way, especially the way society is today, there's so many definitions mm-hmm. of what men are. What's great is that, you know, me and Russ do kind of tag team in a way, you know, we give two very big different perceptions of what we think are men. So the kids kind of get both areas and kind of they're getting essentially information from two different people. So hopefully with that, they can kind of decide on what they want to do. But we always do keep in mind on, you know, what they ultimately want to be, whether it's a professional athlete, an engineer, a doctor, whatever. These goals that we're trying to teach them, hopefully, kind of goes into that mentality. And that's what we kind of want to have them carry on as they get older.
Talking to Marquise Mason and Russ Faulkner. They're with the program Young and Gifted. It's a mentoring program geared toward middle school boys in Madison. They're telling us about some of the goals and some of what you do. You cook the boys dinner a lot of nights. Talk us through one of these dinner nights, Marquise.
Yeah, it's actually really funny. So me and Russ usually, we have a week where we decide. It's really just, I mean, along with, you know, helping me cook myself, I just kind of think of it as like, okay, well, you know, what are the boys like? I usually have a list of what the stuff that they like, and we kind of make it according to that. We're actually under this grant called FYI, which is a Fit Youth Initiative. So it's basically just exposing kids to nutritious meals or nutritious things that they wouldn't ordinarily get at home. So we kind of base it around that, but we don't shy away from making something that's good. I think last week we had jambalaya. So they're very healthy meals, but they're, you know, they'll fill you up, definitely.
Another thing is, you know, I've seen things in different articles and stuff talking about how cooking is kind of, people don't know how to cook anymore. And so that's one of the things sometimes that we can teach the boys, too, is how do you cook? Because both me and Marquise, you know, we know how to cook. And I grew up learning how to cook. So that's another aspect that we introduce the boys to is doing stuff in the kitchen. So.
And they mm-hmm. so they're helping with me. You're not a cooking staff of two. You've got the whole group working
oh,
with
no.
you.
Oh no, yeah, they yeah. chop up vegetables or like we teach them how to cut meat properly. You know, all the safety stuff that goes along with that. So they're always helping. Hopefully they remember it so they can cook it at home. But I think that learning how to cook at a young age is great because I didn't really learn how to cook until I was in college, and by then I was kind of a real human being, so.
Yeah, and it was just ramen.
Ramen, and then anything else I can get that's quick, so.
You know, for anybody, people say food is a great way to bring people together, cooking mm-hmm. and eating it. Do you find that that's a good icebreaker on those meal nights?
Oh, yeah, it's always great. I mean, they have about, you know, 30 minutes to come in and kind of relax. I understand that, you know, they're coming from home, so they're kind of in their mood. So they get to talk, and then, you know, we kind of break bread together and talk about relevant stuff that's going on in their lives, and wherever that conversation goes, it goes.
Are they pretty open about talking to you guys in front of, you know, their peers? There's a lot of stuff that, I don't know, I remember in middle school that I probably wouldn't have wanted to pipe up about.
Yeah.
Both Marquise and I let them know, you know, kind of one of the ground rules is, you know, this is kind of an open space to talk about things. And, you know, basically we don't make fun of each other. So hopefully, you know, whatever the boys feel like they are comfortable talking about, we're open to talking about it. And it's, you know, a lot of the tween teenager stuff that you would normally think about, we definitely talk about. So.
And Marquise, you're doing a lot here. You got a lot. I mean, there's some academics, there's food, there's social and emotional things here. I hate to say, is there more that you wish you were doing that you can't quite do yet? But is there something on the horizon that you want to add into this?
Yeah. So unfortunately, we get about 4 hours a week, 4 to 6 hours a week with the boys. I would love it if I just had a middle school boys program. But due to our center and our size and, you know, kind of the time constraints, we don't have that. My ultimate goal is to get a curriculum that every center can use. and it can kind of tailor it according to their centers, because every center has their different needs. I don't want this to be something that's kind of based out of school, just because they go to school for 8 hours a day. I don't want them to come and think they have to do like another 2.5. So along with academics, you know, I just want to, we together want to kind of make a curriculum that every center can use, because in a sense, there's a lot of stuff that isn't being addressed.
Russ, do you feel like when the kids come in, they're thinking, oh, great, this is more school? Or are they enthusiastic? Are they glad to be involved in that?
No, I mean, they're not under contract to show up. They show up because they want to show up. And no, it's definitely not school. And a lot of times, their behaviors will be different from school to center. You'll find that a lot in after-school programs and other stuff, that the behaviors will be different. But no, they show up because they want to.
Marquise, as we wrap up, this is a Madison, a local effort. These are things that people all over the state are dealing with, though, the issues you're dealing with there. Can you talk about some of the success you're seeing, maybe reasons for other communities to try something like this?
We've noticed together that we're getting more boys from around the area, which is great. And we're, because of the success that we've had in our program, a lot of more parents are feeling comfortable bringing their kids to our center, which is great. And that's what I want for every other center. This isn't a Kennedy Heights, just us all together. Like, I want every center to know that, you know, we can all do this together. We need to help this achievement gap. There's so much going on in Madison, I guess we don't really talk about, but I know that we can help this issue that we have in Madison right now with the boys program.
Well, guys, thanks so much for telling us about the program today.
Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity.
I'm talking to Marquise Mason and Russ Faulkner. They're co-facilitators of the Boys Mentoring Program, Young and Gifted, at the Kennedy Heights Community Center in Madison. Join us to talk about mentorship for middle school boys. Coming up after the news, we'll learn about Jewish cuisine with a Mediterranean flavor on Food Friday, just in time for Passover. It starts at sundown tonight. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. Listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. Coming up, recap the week in Wisconsin news with Rob Mentzer. First, Jewish families around the globe will be sitting down to mark the first night of Passover. It's one of the most important holidays in Judaism, celebrating the Jews' freedom from slavery in Egypt. In the United States, a lot of people, Jewish or otherwise, are familiar with traditional Passover dishes, matzo ball soup, slow-cooked brisket. But for people looking to add something a little different to their meal, they can look to different Jewish traditions, the Jewish community hailing from around the Mediterranean, for ideas. Joining us now to talk about Mediterranean Jewish cuisine is Joyce Goldstein. She's a restaurant consultant, cooking instructor, and the author of several cookbooks. Her most recent is The New Mediterranean Jewish Table, Old World Recipes for the Modern Home. Joyce, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, I'm happy to be here, Rob.
Well, you start off in your book with a history lesson. I'd like to do that, too. Here in the United States, a lot of our Jewish immigrants were from Eastern Europe, and that's the kind of food I tend to think about when I think of Jewish cuisine. Introduce us to this whole other world around the Mediterranean.
Okay. Most of the Jews that did come to this country came from sort of cold weather climate, Eastern Europe. So it's sort of a meat and potatoes diet. Doesn't depend on seasonality because it's meat and potatoes. In the Mediterranean, Jews have been living there since biblical times. In the Muslim countries of, you know, Iraq, Iran, Syria, Jordan, Lebanon, they've been there since the days of the Bible. They've been in North Africa, in Morocco, Tunisia, Algeria, Egypt, and Libya, also since ancient times. And in Spain and Portugal, the Jews lived there, but after the Inquisition, the Spanish Inquisition, they had to leave. These are the Sephardic Jews. And some of them went to Italy, most of them went to Greece and Turkey. So you have these three distinctive recipe collections. One is the Sephardic recipe collection. One is the Maghrebi, which is North African, a little bit spicier, a little bit more complex in seasoning. And then the Arabic tradition, the Jews living in Arabic lands. And all of this is based on freshness, seasonality, an abundance of fruit and vegetables, small portions of meat and poultry, but a very healthy diet, grains, legumes, sort of the opposite of the Ashkenazi diet, and infinitely more varied. And everybody knows that the Mediterranean diet is like the healthiest diet you could eat. So I'd like people to think that they can, now when they say Jewish food, they can also think Mediterranean diet, that in fact there is Jewish food there.
Well, food is at the center of a lot of cultural traditions. Can you talk about the role food plays in Jewish traditions, maybe here in the United States specifically?
Well, we have different kinds of Jews. We have observant Jews, and then we have Jews who identify with being Jewish but are not necessarily keeping a kosher home or even going to synagogue that often. But there's something about an ethnic identity. So for younger people who have grown up in homes that are not kosher, they've eaten widely all over. They've had Chinese and Thai and now Israeli, which is starting to show them Mediterranean Jewish food, surprisingly. And I think it adds a greater variety, and also the way people want to eat today, which is a healthier, more varied diet. For older generations, this is a big jump for them. It's hard to give up your favorites. And my theory is maybe have brisket once or twice a year, but eat Mediterranean food the rest of the year, because you know, if you stay on an Ashkenazi diet exclusively forever, you will not live a very long life.
Well, talk us through some of the main ingredients. What are some of the flavors we're going to encounter in your book, and what are some of the ingredients that we want in our kitchen if we're going to start cooking here?
Okay. Basically, in the Mediterranean, everybody is playing with a similar vegetable and fruit pantry. Everybody's got eggplant, peppers, tomatoes, asparagus, artichokes, all of that, squashes. Everybody will have herbs. Some countries prefer cilantro, others prefer dill or mint. Everyone will have garlic and onions. So they're playing with the same larder, but what distinguishes the food of all these different parts of the world are the use of spices and herbs. The Sephardic Jews like dill, they like mint, they love a lot of lemon. Lemon is on everything. And then there'll be some cinnamon or allspice. But those are basically the flavors. Then you get to North Africa, and it's coriander, cumin, cayenne, hot peppers, saffron, cinnamon. It's a spice riot, and as well as cilantro and parsley and mint. And then when you get to the Middle East, new flavors come in, like sumac and za'atar, which sumac is a lemony flavor, too. And these get added to the larder as well. It's not as spicy as North African cooking, and it has a use of tahini, which is creamier and rich, and a perfect substitute for when you can't use dairy with meat. So there are three distinctive palates. And, of course, you can mix and match, but I think whenever you get a new recipe, you should make it straight the first time. See if you like it. See if your family likes it. And if not, say, what would you like to do to change it? And then maybe make adjustments.
We're talking to Joyce Goldstein. Her new book is called The New Mediterranean Jewish Table, Old World Recipes for the Modern Home. And Joyce, you've sold me on all of these. These all sound like great flavors. So I want to get cooking here. You've got a few recipes that you've provided. We've got them linked on the Central Time Facebook page. And one uses green garlic. And I want to start there because, you know, we're starting farmers market season here. That's something that appears early. A recipe for Turkish lamb with green garlic. Can you talk us through that recipe?
Absolutely. Well, green garlic looks a little bit like a leek or a big fat scallion, and it's the garlic before the bulbs have formed. So you make a basic lamb stew, which has a little bit of vinegar and a little tomato paste, and then you blanch green onions and green garlic separately, and then brown them a little bit in the pan and add them to the stew. And they add the perfume to this. I mean, it's not a beautiful stew. You're not going to look at it and say, oh my God, let's take a photo of it. But it is so delicious in flavor. And if you want to add some color, you could throw some peas or fava beans in there for little bright notes of green at the end. But I've been making this for Passover for the past, I say, 4 or 5 years since I got this recipe. and everybody loves it, so I'm not going to give it up.
Well, and, you know, we were talking about the brisket earlier, and if you're looking to convert someone over from that sort of meat and potatoes idea, this sounds like a recipe that could be a good starting point. It's got some meat in there, got some stewed meat, but a lot of healthy stuff alongside it. This seems like a good way to cross over from that Eastern European to that Mediterranean-style Jewish cooking.
I think it's an easy transition. I think any of the lamb stews in the book would work. I mean, there's some beautiful tagines with raisins and almonds, too, that are lovely and perhaps, you know, a little bit sweeter for people used to eating their brisket prepared with Coca-Cola or cranberry sauce. That might be a nice transition. There's also wonderful chicken dishes that are sweet and sour. I mean, chicken with apricots and tomatoes, which is delicious, or the Persian chicken with pomegranate and walnuts, which would be great at the Seder. I just think it means changing your mindset and maybe keeping the beginning of the meal that's familiar. Still make the matzo ball soup. Let people have that. But then segue into a new main course or one of the desserts from the Middle East, which are just fabulous.
And at the same time, this would be a good crossover food for people who aren't Jewish, who aren't part of this tradition, to be introduced to this Mediterranean Jewish food you're talking about.
Absolutely. You do not have to be Jewish to cook Mediterranean food. There are millions of Mediterranean cookbooks with great food. But if you are Jewish and you want to follow the kosher laws, then you know you're not going to be getting any recipes for pork or for shellfish or meat with dairy. Otherwise, it's straight Mediterranean food, tons of vegetable and grain dishes, even keeping vegetarians and vegans happy, which we want to do these days. So I think the variety that's available is incredible.
You had a good substitution on one of the recipes. I think there's one that was what would usually be a scallop recipe that's off the Jewish table, but you I think used turkey breast in cut up in sort of scallop sizes.
Oh, the scallopini, yes. There you just pound the meat, saute it. You can dip it in matzah meal for Passover, obviously, or you might use flour or panko otherwise, but matzah meal right now, and saute it in a little bit of olive oil and deglaze the pan with some lemon juice, or if you have a little bit of even lemon marmalade, a little lemon marmalade and water, which would be really, really fun, and it would be delicious.
We are talking to Joyce Goldstein, talking about Mediterranean Jewish cuisine. A Passover starts tonight. Some meals for Passover observations or for anybody all the rest of the year. She's a cookbook author. Her newest one is the New Mediterranean Jewish Table, Old World Recipes for the Modern Home. You can join in now at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about this style of cooking? What goes into it? Do you have a favorite Passover meal, Passover recipe? Do you like Mediterranean foods in general? Do you have some cooking questions for Joyce? Call in now at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. And while you're there, you can find the recipe for Turkish lamb with green garlic and a couple more recipes we're going to talk about in just a few moments. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now about Mediterranean Jewish cuisine with Joyce Goldstein. She's a cookbook author, cooking instructor, and her most recent book is The New Mediterranean Jewish Table, Old World Recipes for the Modern Home. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're coming from what we think of in the United States as traditional Jewish food of Eastern European origins, maybe you have a question for Joyce about how to Mediterranean up some of your meals. Or if you're coming from a non-Jewish tradition, you want to know how all this comes together, some cooking ideas to inspire your own cooking, call in now, 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page, pick up some recipes, and we'll go to our callers. Monique is on the line in Racine. Monique, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I used to work for a gentleman a while ago, and he was of Jordanian descent, and his mother came in one time, and in the back room on a single hot plate and in one pot, she made this dish, and I only remember the translation. It was upside down. So it was consisted of potatoes, and there was lamb, and I think there were some other vegetables, and you basically prepare the whole thing in this one pot, or that's the way she did it at least, and then when you serve it, you turn it upside down, and then that's how that's presented.
Monique, and that recipe is in the book. It's called Tas Kebab, and it's Turkish, and it is the upside-down lamb stew. Some make it with potatoes. Many more make it with rice. But, yes, it's a delicious dish, and it's made in one pot, and then you put a plate over it and tip it over. And, yes, you can find that recipe. So if you liked it, you'll get it in this book.
Monique, thanks for calling. And Joyce, can you say the name of that recipe for me again?
Tas Kebab, T-A-S-K-E-B-A-B. See, most people think kebab is something on a stick, but in Turkish cooking, a kebab is a stew.
And what's the deal with it, the upside-down part, flipping it over at the end?
Well, what happens is you make the lamb stew, then you add the rice, and, well, it makes for a nice presentation. It's sort of flashy. And here's this woman that had only a hot plate, so for her it was a matter of necessity. But it just makes for a more dramatic presentation. There are also some stews, chicken and things, that are put in like a phyllo crust and turned out upside down. And that's called veiled pilaf. It's rice and chicken and flavorings in phyllo. And even moussaka, like when the Turks do moussaka, they do it differently than the Greeks. They take the slices of eggplant and line like a charlotte mold or a souffle dish and put the filling in there and then flip the eggplant over, cook it, let it sit for a while. You can't unmold it right away or it'll go splat, but you let it sit for about 15 minutes, put a plate on top, turn it over, and it's this beautiful shape. It's for presentation.
Well, Monique, good luck making that tas kebab, and let us know when you've perfected it. We'll stop by. We'll go now to Don in Eau Claire. Don, hi.
Oh, hi. My wife and I had a copy of Ms. Goldstein's earlier book by the similar name. And we've used Moroccan cooking, enjoyed Moroccan cooking. My question is, I have made Moroccan preserved lemons many times, and I always start with like six lemons and end up with a jar full of them, which when the next season comes around, I've never used them all.
Uh-oh.
And I wondered if you had any suggestions for using Moroccan lemons.
Don, thanks. So he's got too many Moroccan preserved lemons. Good problem to have. What does he do with them?
That's a good question. First of all, when I make them, I guess I never try to do more than four lemons, like in a pint jar, because you don't, unless you're running a restaurant, you're not going to go through them in vast numbers. But there are a couple of stews in the book that use the peel of preserved lemons. So if you're doing the lamb with lemon and olives or the chicken, you'll probably use one whole lemon right there. You can chop up the peel and put it in a flavored mayonnaise or an aioli and serve that with just some cooked asparagus, you know, whatever you like. You can use the chopped peel in a vinaigrette, lemon juice, olive oil, some chopped preserved lemon peel, salt and pepper, and use that as a salad dressing. And, I think people put up too much at one time. And I've learned, unless you're doing this commercially, it pays to do it in small batches, even two at a time in a little pint jar, squish them down and put them in there. Because they only take 6 weeks to cure, and, you know, but you can find new uses, too. I mean, if you're cooking roast chicken, you can chop up the peel and make a little sauce for that, or even tuck one inside the chicken when you're roasting it. I like it in stews. I like the strips of peel thrown into the stews.
Don, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Joyce Goldstein. Her new cookbook, The New Mediterranean Jewish Table, Old World Recipes for the Modern Home. Still time for you to join in if you have a question about Mediterranean cooking, Jewish cuisine, bringing them together, or a question about maybe something you've eaten, want to try to recreate. 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page and find a few recipes there from Joyce, including Joyce, one for Swiss chard and chickpeas. I want to hear more about this because chard, I like it okay. I never know exactly what to do with it. I get it at farmer's market, CSA. Talk us through this recipe for Swiss chard and chickpeas.
Well, all right. First, you soak the chickpeas overnight, and then you cook them and save them in their cooking liquid. And then you braise the Swiss chard. You add onions. And then there are two versions of that recipe in the book. One of them is sort of a milder Sephardic one, basically onions, garlic, chickpeas and greens with a squeeze of lemon. But then there's the North African one, which has quite a bit of lively spices in the onion. And for people that want to see Swiss chard in a maybe a more exciting way, I would recommend that recipe because there you have the spices which add a little bit of complexity to the dish.
Joyce, I like to cook. I am sometimes lazy. If I use canned chickpeas, do I lose points?
No, you don't lose points. Nothing will happen to you.
but you do make the case in the book for when we can getting the fresher and more home-prepared ingredients. That does make a difference.
Well, I think with chickpeas, it's one thing. If you're just throwing them into a stew and it's not the major ingredient, I think that's fine. But I think if you were making a chickpea salad where the chickpeas are the star, then I would want to prepare them from scratch. I even think making hummus. I mean, you can make hummus with canned chickpeas, but I think it's a lot better if you make it with the dried that you soak. It just depends on how much of a stickler you are and how important texture is to you.
Yeah, you had a soup that had chickpeas, lentils, and rice, and you recommended cooking them separately because they all have different cooking times, and then you get that great variety of texture in the soup.
Right, right. Well, see, I'm a nut about texture. I haven't been in the restaurant business for many, many years. Texture is one of the things that either turns people on or off, so texture is key. And in the old days, you know, when they had that just one burner, they threw everything in. So the rice was overcooked, the chickpeas were okay, the lentils were a little too soft, and it didn't matter. But if you're a fanatic about texture, then you will cook the lentils, you'll cook the rice, you'll cook the chickpeas, and then you'll put them together so that each one has textural integrity. And that may be part of my craziness, but it's important to me.
And Joyce, I'm a fanatic about dessert, and you left us with one of those, a Sephardic orange cake with almonds. And you're actually starting off boiling the oranges.
Oh, yeah, this is an interesting tradition. There's also a baklava in there made with that pureed orange, or a couple of cakes. The Jews were responsible for the cultivation and trade of citrus fruits in the Mediterranean, because at Sukkot, one of their holidays, they have to have the citron called the etrog. And when the Arabs brought all the citrus from China, the Jews took over the cultivation and the trade. And so you will find lots of desserts using oranges and lemon. And lemons, of course, are everywhere. But these cooked orange ones are gorgeous, and the cake retains a very moist texture. And it's actually better the second day. If you're having it for Seder, you should have made it yesterday, is what I want to say. but it has a lovely texture and a perfume of the orange, and it pairs beautifully with the almonds.
Well, Joyce, as we wrap up, what is on your Seder table tonight?
Well, we are having salmon with rhubarb and tomato sauce, because there was rhubarb at my farmer's market this week, and that's a lovely Turkish sweet and sour sauce that it just plays up the fish beautifully. And we're having the lamb with green garlic. We are creatures of habit now. That's one of our favorites. And we are having the orange and almond cake, which I did make yesterday because it's a favorite. And I'll serve it with berries and maybe some slivers of orange, you know, orange segments, little orange flower water.
And everybody who's eating with you has been converted to the Mediterranean-style cooking, I imagine.
They're my family. They have no choice.
They have no choice. All right, well, Joyce, thank you so much. It's been a lot of fun, and this food all sounds so good.
Well, get cooking. You have the book now.
I'm stuck here at work. You know what? I'll just run home now.
Okay,
right, this show can
now.
Host itself. All right, Joyce, have a great day.
Bye-bye.
That's Joyce Goldstein. She's a cookbook author. We've been talking about her newest book. It's called The New Mediterranean Jewish Table, Old World Recipes for the Modern Home. Joins us today ahead of Passover to give us some Jewish recipes, not the stuff we're familiar with, mostly here in the United States, things that came over from Eastern Europe, your brisket, things from around the Mediterranean world. A lot of variety there, and you can find some of that variety. Try making it for yourself over on the Central Time Facebook page. We had the recipes we talked about today, Swiss chard and chickpeas, the Turkish-style lamb with green garlic, and that dessert recipe that sounds so good, Sephardic orange cake with almonds. So pick those up. Get the links on the Central Time Facebook page. Make them. Hey, maybe send us a picture over the weekend if you cooked them. Let us know how it turned out. A contested convention is still a possibility for Republican presidential candidates. If none of them can reach that threshold needed to win on the first ballot this summer, well, who knows what happens then? There's been a lot of talk about maybe someone not on the ballot ending up as the nominee. A lot of talk about House Speaker Paul Ryan of Wisconsin. Now, he said, no, don't do it. I don't want it. Earlier this week, he appeared on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert on CBS. Colbert really subtly tried to pin him down on the issue.
Yes or no, would you accept the nomination?
No, Stephen, I have said I do not want nor would I accept the Republican nomination.
Got it. So you're considering the nomination? No, no, I'm not. Okay, I'll give you some time to mull this one over. How about now? Still no. So that's a maybe? No, it's a no. Like a no-no? Or one of those, no, I don't want to be Speaker of the House, but I'll accept it if you just give it to me no's? It's a no-no. And two no-nos make a yes?
And it went on with no's ultimately in English, in German, and in Russian. The conclusion, Paul Ryan does not appear to be in the running for president. For now. Coming up next is news from NPR and WPR, then a look at some of the top state news stories in our weekly Wisconsin News Roundup. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.